Welcome to Novel Spotlight, the podcast where published fiction writers are interviewed to gather their insights and writing lessons so we can use them to make ourselves better and more effective writers. There are just three things I ask of you, if appropriate to you and your experience. Please subscribe, please click on the like button, and please share this program link with any family members, friends, or colleagues who might be interested or benefit from the content. Now, on with our program. In the spotlight is DM Brockington. She is from another dimension. I'm not sure if she's from the astral plane or the causal plane, from outer space, or maybe from one of the infinite number of so-called multiverses that are out there, multiple universes that physicists talk about, at least some physicists, or if she sprang forth whole cloth from a Ouija board, for that matter. She may have been abducted by aliens and probed. All of these questions are unanswerable until I start posing some questions here. But before I do that, here's what we do know. DM Brockington writes about witches and the paranormal. She's from the low country of South Carolina. She's fascinated by witches and psychic abilities. When she's not reading urban fantasy, paranormal, or contemporary fiction novels, she's writing them. She has more books than she has time to read. She also has a love-hate relationship with Netflix. She loves all the options, like we all do, but what a time suck it is. And she looks for a story in everything. And that's a good thing, because she's got a pretty substantial body of work with titles that include things such as Rise of the Millennial Witch, Uncloaked, and Our Little Secrets. The list goes on from there, and DM Brockington is currently working on a female vampire series for midlife women, middle-aged women. DM Brockington, welcome to Novelist Spotlight.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
We're going to get to where you really came from, whether you're a walk-in or something like that, but let me start by asking you to speak to this fascination you have with the paranormal. When did that start, and was there any root of it?
So in my teens, in the early, mid-90s, or 80s rather, my first husband, we were high school sweethearts. He was an avid comic book collector, and all things Marvel, DC Comics, and he really introduced me to superheroes. And there weren't a lot of superheroes that looked like me, a black girl at the time, now an older black woman. But I fell in love with the idea of folks with powers, with skills, with like that supernatural thing. And so years later, The Craft comes out, the original, and it was amazing. And then we have Buffy the Vampire Slayer, the movie first, and then the series. One of my favorite movies of all times, The Lost Boys, Kiefer Sutherland. And so I found myself over the decades just really being drawn to these creatures with powers, both good and, you know, and how they choose to use them, both good and bad. But also noticing the gap of African Americans, and especially around witches. When you saw a witch in a movie, she was usually practicing hoodoo or something that's considered very negative, right? And, you know, she was always the bad witch. And so I just kind of was like, I'd like to you know, maybe spin that a little differently. And also, I really feel like we all have a little magic in us and how we choose to use that in our daily lives. And so that's really what I ended up writing, how I came to writing about witches per se. They happen to be my favorite topic. And again, because I'm a black woman who I just think I'm magical in my own little way every day. And I wanted to highlight that for other women who look like me and who don't look like me.
Right.
And now, especially I'm 55, and I'm proud of that. And we don't stop being magical because we age. And so there's this whole movement happening around women and paranormal fantasy that's for my demographic. And I was like, yes, finally. And also, still aren't a lot of folks that look like me. So that's
I think we get more magical as we age. I mean, don't you? Yes, we get more magical. But as we become more seasoned, we have more experiences, and we start to pick up on the subtleties that we used to ignore, because especially if you're a guy, okay, speaking for the guys in the world, we tend to want the sledgehammer approach. If it's not a sledgehammer, it doesn't get our attention. For instance, music's got to be 130 decibels for us to want to pay attention to it. But as you get older, you start to realize, God, there's a lot of these nuances and subtleties to life that are speaking to us. And I don't mean literally, but they, you know, we're surrounded by input, by sensory data. Now, I did notice that your books, you do have black people on the cover. You have black men, you have black women. And, but, you know, you're fascinated with witches. And, you know, there's the white witch, which is supposed to be the good witch. And then there's the black witch, which is the evil witch. So it's kind of color-coded. I've always, and, you know, you hear even black people will say, you know, I've had some really dark moods. And it always, it always felt a little funny to me, because it's kind of like people have always associated, you know, black and white in ways that have been prejudicial. But, you know, even black people, they buy into the concept of a dark mood being a bad thing. And with the understanding that it really doesn't have anything to do with skin color. It just has to do with we're just naming something. But it just runs across so many different categories. Do you feel at all that you're limiting your audience by, or you're opening up an audience? Clearly you're opening up an audience for black or African-American readers. But do you also feel that there's this huge audience of vampire readers out there? There's no question about that, because that Anne Rice started it, and then what's her name? Stephanie Meyer really capitalized on it after Anne Rice really kind of pioneered it. I think she pioneered it. I might be wrong about that. Vampires may have been predated her even just in terms of a fiction writer. But now, you know, I lost my train of thought. I didn't even know where I was going with that.
Well, I think your original question was...
Oh, yeah, your audience, have you opened it up?
My audience.
Yeah, is it broader? Is it? Do you feel like you're in any way... and we've seen people like Terry McMillan who have a big audience, but and it's primarily black readers. But does that factor into anything you're doing? Do you have any feelings one way or the other about that?
So I kind of don't have any feelings because I about it in terms of I'm writing what I want to read. And the truth is I've had lots of readers who don't look like me who've read my books and who have enjoyed them and have been like, hey, girl, when's that next one coming out? Because I'm just kind of sitting here waiting. And so I think what we're finding is, especially with the diversity movement in publishing right now, that audiences now understand that they were funneled to particular works based on race, and the internet, in for good or for bad, has been able to help us kind of tear down some of those artificial like avenues to readers, and so you don't. Who is really, besides me, still going in Barnes & Noble and perusing the aisles? A lot of folks spend a lot of time, for good or bad, on Amazon looking at the bestseller list. They're not being told. Amazon's like, if you read this book, you'll enjoy this book. Well, that next book they recommend might have an African-American character. That's legit how I've found other books is Amazon's like, just based on an algorithm, if you like this, you might enjoy this.
Do you think that's helpful, though? I mean, do you think it's helpful? I mean, in some ways it's helpful, but do you feel like it allows for discovery? Is that what you're saying, or do you feel like it...
I think it allows for discovery in a way that walking into a bookstore doesn't. Because, again, my filter for this is in the 90s and the 2000s. I would say is when early 2000s is when the publishing industry was like, oh my God, Black people do read, and we will, you know, purchase and publish a crap ton of books for them. But they pigeonholed us in the Black section of the bookstore. Well, there's technically no Black section of Amazon. I mean, you could Google African American fiction or African American romance, but most of the time folks will just Google sci-fi fantasy. And boom, I could end up reading something by an Asian author, a Native American author. Like, they're just going to tell me, they're going to show me who's ranking high in the in terms of sales.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not, this is the Black section of Amazon, this is the Asian section, or this is the women's section. So the question is, how do you get enough sales these days to climb higher in the algorithm versus how do I get out of the Black section of the bookstore so that other folks find me as well?
No, Amazon doesn't have a Black section, though. I mean, Amazon is much more, for instance, if I'm interested in vampires, then your new,
right.
This is a new series you're starting, your midlife right. vampire novel likely will pop up because, hey, you're interested
right.
in vampires and our demographic says you're about middle age, so boom. So
exactly.
This is going to be a help to you and
yeah,
authors. I hope so, too, because we do need more of that with these connections because serendipity has been lost in a lot of ways because of the Internet, including in news. People just devouring news that is just a repetition of what they already believe instead of being offered some different vantage points, some different points of view. So I notice your books are all about, I'd say they average about 125 pages, which, is it fair to say you write novellas more than a novel? I always think in terms of that length being more novella, where 300 to 400 or more is a novel. Does that length, is that calculated, or do you feel like when you're writing, hey, that's where I finished, that's where I was done telling the story, and that's where I stopped?
So it's both, because as a busy, so when I started writing and thinking about writing seriously, I was smack dab in the middle of being a busy single mom working full time with a teenager or tween to teen theater student. So she was a regular student by day and then doing theater in school and on the weekends. And so I needed things that I could read quickly that, you know, I might be sitting at a rehearsal for a couple of hours, and how great it would be able to power through something short from beginning to end and get a full story and then be done with it and not worry about, oh, it'll be like 2 or 3 weeks before I can pick this book back up and get back into it and yada, yada, yada. So I typically, while I still love a good, solid read, these days I am craving something that I can spend 2 hours on a Saturday that may be all I have for that weekend to just deep dive into a story, and I get a full-on story. So something longer than a short story, but nothing too long that I'm going to have to put it down and salivate or anticipate when I'm going to be able to come back to it, and it's like a couple of weeks because of my super busy schedule. So I save like my really juicy reads for vacation, but I'm an avid reader, and I've been a reader, you know, basically all my life. And the older I get, I just found how much more difficult it is for me to be able to just read.
Uninterrupted time.
Yes.
Well, now,
so,
you're writing books of this length. Do you feel that the sensibilities of today, especially with young people, maybe not just young people, you're finding, and we all find it difficult to find time to literally sit down and read. But do you think the sensibilities of today call for shorter reads of this kind because people tend to be favoring shorter form?
Mm-hmm. I think we have untrained our brains in terms of, like, and I use that term untrained specifically because I can think back to my 20s where being lost in a 300 or 400 page book all day, like I could literally just read one book all day, finish the book, and not feel anything other than joy at the fact that I spent a whole day reading. To think about spending more than an hour to 2 hours at a time reading now feels like extreme luxury.
Yeah.
Because of how we work and live these days. Whereas back in the day, my mom, you know, as a teenager, my mom would be like, you know, what are you going to do all day? And I'd be like, read this book. And my family would be like, oh, okay, yeah, that's what she's going to do. I was the kid that was, when told to go outside, I took a book with me. And I was sitting under the tree. And I like to think about being able to, like, somebody tell me to go outside and take a book with me and sit under a tree and read all afternoon. I don't even know if my brain would be able to get past an hour of doing that anymore.
You know, I just watched the documentary about Kurt Vonnegut called Unstuck in Time. And one of the things that was revealed in that was that he left General Electric, where he was in the public relations department. He started writing magazine articles. He was making lots of money because at that time, what people had was they had the radio. They didn't have television yet. And he was, and so magazine articles were the television of their time because you would, much like radio, I suppose, also, you get these visual images as you read. If you've got any imagination at all, that's one of the magic things about reading is that as you read, you co-create the characters along with the author. But then television came along and he said it destroyed my magazine writing career, writing short stories for magazines. And it turned out that it took him a long time. It wasn't until Slaughterhouse-Five and he became famous that he started making the kind of money he used to make writing short stories for magazines. And magazines needed lots of short stories. So there are a lot of authors writing and they're making good money. And boom, along comes television. That's the battle that gets fought by everybody who writes a novel. And I will say the short form, yeah, absolutely. But on the other hand, one of the greatest things that you can experience, I think, in reading is get your hands on a really big novel and it be like a long love affair that you're able to read that thing over and probably intentionally spacing it out, reading it over weeks or even months because you want to savor it. You want it to go on and on. You don't want the relationship to end because when it's over, you better hope that that author is going to write another book as good, or he or she may be on an entirely different subject matter. And it's like, you know, Don DeLillo is one of my favorite novelists. There's three novels in particular I just absolutely love of his. And it's like, why can't you write more like that? And he's got a bunch of others that the critics like, but they're just not as good as the big three in my conception. Have you had a paranormal experience, DM? Have you had a spiritual experience, an out-of-body experience, a paranormal experience, or is it all conceptual?
That's a great question. In years of interviews, no one's ever asked me that, so I'm going to have to remember that.
It seems like it's
someone.
So obvious. You're writing about the paranormal and fantasy, and nobody's asked you if you've left your body.
So, ironically, I think I have truly had moments of premonition, precognition. And old school folks would be like, that's just really deja vu and you've told yourself you've done this before. But I can give you a prime example. I was in my 20s. I was finishing up. It was my last semester at the University of South Carolina, and I was about to get married on graduation day. And about, I would say at the start of the semester, so about 4 months from me graduating and, you know, moving on to real adulthood, I had a dream that I was, that I had given birth to a girl and I was in another country. And my high school sweetheart, who was my first husband, was there, and I just remember him handing me a little girl, and I could not hear what he said, but his lips were moving, and I woke up, and that dream stayed with me, and I was like, ugh, that's, yeah, I always, and here's the thing, I always wanted boys, because boys love their mamas. Girls tend to be daddy's girls, and they, you know, they tend to, you know, fight with, I'm the oldest of five. My mom and I didn't have a contentious relationship, and I'm very fortunate, but I just know girls and their moms. And so I just wanted a boy, because boys just seemed to, like, their mothers were the light of their lives, or the boys that I knew and was dealing with. And fast forward about, so I was probably 20 because I graduated, yeah, I was 21 when I had that dream. And 7 years later, I am in a hospital room after delivery, and everything is, and I was in Germany. My ex-husband's military. We were stationed in Germany at the time, and I'm in the hospital bed, and I'm having this, wow, this feels weird moment. And then Darren, my ex, hands me our daughter. And even in that moment where my moment of joy of, oh my God, here's this baby, here's this kid, I realized this is, I knew this was coming. And that's the biggest instance for me of having, like, oh no. And I, that dream never left me. Even in my pregnancy, we never found out the sex of our kid because I wanted it to be a surprise. But in my heart of hearts, I already knew. And I can tell you I already knew because about a month before she was born, we had picked out all these names. And I was like, you know what? I'm not liking the girl name. And he was like, what do you mean? Because we, you know, we labored with, you know, we were being intentional as parents and choosing this name, and it had to be a consensus between the two of us. And a month out, I'm changing the game, and I was like, this kid is not, we were going to name her Austin Nicole. And I was like, this kid is not an Austin. And he was like, well, we better come up with whatever this girl, if this is a girl, whatever this name is. And we went back and forth for about an hour, and then I said, Tyler, and he looked at me and he was like, Tyler Nicole. And that's how we chose her name. And so even then I knew that this girl was coming. I wasn't going to get my boy, and I only have one child.
And you want to make sure you settled on a name. It was important to know.
It was important that the name fit. And it was interesting because we never told our parents, because we're Southerners from Charleston, and naming a girl Tyler or Austin is not, now it's the norm, but, you know, 28
no,
years
back
ago.
Back then it needed to be Ashley or Savannah or...
Right.
Right. And they had a middle name, and they might use their middle name as their first name, not their first name.
I
lived in Charlotte, North Carolina for a while, and I was surprised by how many women use their middle name, maybe men too, but I definitely noticed it with the women. So Charleston, what a beautiful city. You're a Gamecock. You said you went to University of South Carolina, so you're a South Carolina Gamecock. What did you study?
Government and International Studies with a minor in psychology. I was going to go to law school.
Well, never mind that. Never mind that. Give me another paranormal experience. We don't want to talk about law. Let me ask, first of all, is Tyler your one and only child?
My one and only.
And she's a mama's girl, hopefully.
She is now, which is interesting. I think around college, she was always a daddy's girl, and then about high school, they just wild out, and they lose their minds, and they're like,
yeah, it's the hormones.
The parents' goal is just to keep them alive. Yeah. But college was when I was like, oh my God, I think I really like you again. And she was like, you know what? I kind of like you. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's amazing how the children, they come back. I say that to parents sometimes. He'll be back or she'll be back. They have to go out to the wilderness for a while. They have to establish their own sense of self, and then think better of it later. So was a story, did you ever write a book based on that, kind of a Rosemary's Baby sort of thing? I mean, obviously Tyler was not a bad baby. I'm just saying that you had this precognitive experience and it related to a baby. Did you ever use a baby, a woman giving birth to a child, as part of a paranormal or witch oriented story?
So I actually haven't. And it's funny, probably because I only have one child, many of my characters, so I have a series, the Walker Sisters, and it's the Charleston Supernatural series, and this is a set of three sisters. They are 30s to like late 20s to late 30s. None of them are married yet. None of them have kids. And I'm finding that when I write, my characters are either kid-free or they only have one. And typically they're, because I'm writing about older women, if they have a kid, their kid's out of the house. The kid's gone. Which I think was just, that's just probably a byproduct of my single parentness after my ex and I divorced. She spent the summers with her dad, and I was very fortunate to be able to co-parent with a highly engaged parent, even though he was still active duty military. He built the summers around her, and so I would get burnt out during the year, the school year, the day-to-day, and we'd trade off for holidays, and I'd get a reprieve, but the summers were always mine. Mm-hmm. And that was a joy that I feel like was a gift. That was a gift that I did not, I didn't look that gift horse in the mouth, so to speak. Like, I realized that I was being handed a gift that many single parents didn't have, and I used it to my advantage a lot. And so actually, when she was gone for the summer, I could read, 100 books during the summer because I didn't have to parent. And
right.
When I did take some days off, that was me time. So I could build 3 months out of the year where it was total focus on just me, myself, and I, and all the cool things I wanted to do. And so I realized, there are probably some women who live this way without kids. So no judgment whether you choose to have kids or not. I just was like, I appreciate my kid-free time.
There's a freedom
and
in it.
Yeah, there's a freedom in it. And so most of my characters, I just take kids out of the equation for them, however possible. Because sometimes when you're messing around with magic, and I should have asked you if I can curse, shit goes sideways real mm-hmm. fast. And so you don't want... I actually did write a short story, and not a short story. My very first book, Witch and Ain't Easy, of the Walker Sisters, the very first chapter is a kid gets hit. He's riding his bike through Hampton Park. He gets hit by one of the witches who is having a moment, being selfish and only thinking about herself. She's, in her convertible, top down, music bumping. She hits this kid. The kid goes flying, cracks his skull against the tree. He hits the tree and he dies. And she is a time walker, so she has the ability to reverse time. But just like with magic, to whom much is given, much is required, you can't use magic in this particular world to benefit yourself in that way. And so, but she reverses time so that she doesn't hit the kid, but it has these far-reaching implications.
So she can erase her mistake, but there's ramifications,
right.
Unintended consequences.
Right.
What is a witch? I mean, everybody knows a witch, and they think of the broomstick and the hat, but what are the characteristics of a witch, really?
So if for my world, witches use, they just tap into energy around them to, with whatever, some have more gifts than others, or some have very specific gifts, but to call up those gifts, to use those gifts, so to shift time or to reach, to have precognition or know EFP, know what someone else is thinking or feeling or something horrific that they've done. One sister can, like, walk into someone's unconsciousness, kind of a dream walker. To be able to do that, they're just utilizing energy around them. So just able to tap into the natural energies of the universe.
Yeah,
and
you know,
that thing.
That reminds me when you say the, you know, using the energy around them, a male witch is a warlock. And when I was in college, I say that for the listeners' benefit because not everybody knows that. I know you do. But I knew a guy briefly in college, and he told me he was a warlock, but, you know, he said it runs in my family. And of course, I started asking 100 questions, and he was talking about priests, like, for instance, at the Catholic Church. I was raised a Catholic. So Catholic Church, they wear the black vestments, and he was saying that, you know, if you ask a Catholic why, or a priest, why do you wear black? Well, it's tradition. He says, but that's not really true. They wore black to attract energy, and then they were able to repurpose that energy or use that energy to accomplish things such as healing, let's say. Mm-hmm. And so on. So interesting. So you have
can we talk about energy for a minute? Because I want to give the listeners like a prime example. There are people who can walk into a room and raise the vibration. And we call that person charismatic.
Exactly. Or President of the United States, right?
right. But what all they're doing is tapping into the energy in the room to bring the other folks along. And conversely, there are folks who walk into a room and their energy is negative or dark, and they're sucking. Like when that meeting's done or you're leaving their presence, you feel drained. Because that they're an energy vampire they've pulled from you in order to, like, feed whatever they need fed in that moment. So people think magic in this really big thing, but this is real world stuff happening.
Yes.
And imagine if we can really tune our minds to be intentional about
A person with a personality disorder, I mean, they are basically, you know, manipulating energy, unwittingly manipulating energy in a way that is negative for the people around them. I mean, haven't we all worked with somebody or had a friend who we'd sit down with and they'd start to tell us, you know, oftentimes complaining about their lives. And by time, you know, it doesn't even take a lot of time. It can be 15, 20 minutes. And it's like you're exhausted when they get up and leave or you get up and leave. It's like what you were talking about, but whole higher level when it's an entire room, when they're having an effect on the whole room, like you're saying. But that, yeah, absolutely. And the people, you know, I said I'm a president of the United States because I know a lot of people who met Bill Clinton, and they just said that the entire, when he talks to you, he is right in your face. The whole room disappears. He is not paying attention to anything else but you. And you feel that you're the only person in the world while he's talking to you. And that's a power and that's a talent.
Yes.
It doesn't mean you're going to be a good president. It doesn't mean you're going to make the best decisions, but it does mean that you're influential.
Right.
And that's what it takes to eventually be elected to office. But there's better things to do with influence than necessarily get into politics, for sure. Why vampires? Now, you're going to do a series. Why middle-aged? Well, you did say you're a middle-aged woman. And so I think maybe you feel like you've got, you're really kind of zeroed in on that, but why? And again, I'm going to ask you, and there's nothing wrong with this if the answer is yes, whether it's calculated to some degree, because look, there's a huge audience of people out there, particularly women who love to read about vampires. But then you have a little different angle on it, it sounds like, with the middle age thing.
Yeah, so my vampire, Celine, originally your first question was why vampires? So again, Anne Rice, Interview with a Vampire, amazing. And, you know, we all like saw it. We felt, you know, we just, especially women, fell into this genre. Even though Stoker had written, you know, Dracula way back when, but there's always this fascination with vampires, their sexiness, their ability to, they don't always,
what makes them sexy?
Help, what they want by force.
Help men understand the sexiness of the vampire. Is it the eternal love thing? Is it the blood? Is it, what makes a vampire sexy?
I think it is, again, that charisma thing. We humans are always looking for a way to explain things we don't understand at a at an intellectual level, but that speak to us on a cellular or an energy level. And so I think that attractiveness, you know, there are some folks whose attractiveness is so extreme. And we have to, like, wrap it in mythology to make it make sense. And the flip side is people are always looking, no matter – here's why people always love a celebrity, like, gaffe, because it makes – then, you know, if they do something really horrific or, like, you know, Will Smith slapping Chris Rock, you know, they're – There's that sense of schadenfreude. I know I'm pronouncing that wrong, but you know, a joy in the misfortune of others. And also then you're like, ah, see, you're just a regular dude who screws up just like the rest of us. So I think that's the thing, like with super attractive people that, you know, to put fangs on them and give them like an ugly side just makes them, oh, okay, you're not as amazeballs as we think you are, but, or, there's a dark side to you as well.
But let me piggyback on that example you're using before I let you continue, because I do think when you talk about the negative energy thing, I feel like the person to blame on that, well, Will has to take the blame, but Jada Pinkett Smith, you know, this, I just get this vibe from her that, look, it's me and you and the children against the world. And I don't feel like she was there for him. She didn't stop him. She starts yelling right next to her. She doesn't reach out and say, calm down. He laughed originally at the comment.
Yeah.
And then he saw his wife rolling her eyes and saying, here we go again. And he gets up on his feet. Now, he's got to take the blame for that. But you talk about maybe some bad energy and a bad influence. I've talked to several people who were all in agreement. It's like, they're not going to be married in a year or two because she's not a positive influence on that guy. He loves her a lot more than she loves him. So just that's an aside. So, you talk about a person who's bringing energy to a situation for better or worse. I don't think she brings good energy to that marriage.
So I think there are a whole lot of people that are in agreement. I will say this though, and I have a master's in counseling. I don't use it. I don't use it other than like when I'm
situations like this,
when I'm managing, right? Or I use it when I'm writing. But never underestimate the power of codependency, and never underestimate the power of a shared story. And the thing I think that links those two in a healthy, unhealthy, whatever way you want to describe it, but in a way, I think your assessment, it's us and these kids against the world, is very much true, because that is the story they've told themselves.
Yeah.
And that is the story they've told their children. So And this is ironic, goes back to your introduction of me. I look for story in everything. And I do think that, so I'm one of the few that don't think there'll be, I'm always wrong, so I won't be surprised if I'm wrong, but I don't think that they will be separated or divorced within a year, I think they'll dig even deeper. They're going to dig in even deeper in an us against the world kind of thing. But you're absolutely right. If he were my spouse, I would have just put my hand out and been like, this is not what we're going to do here today. Like, yeah. We need to have some words with Chris. We will have some words with Chris after this. I would not have, like the fact that he got up out of his seat and she did not go behind him to put that hand on his shoulder, that thing to bring him back into this moment and not get escalated into. But again, he was riding an energy wave that he never saw coming.
Yeah.
And
he's never been
he
on before because he's really
never been on.
He hasn't made any real missteps. He's always been a guy who did everything right. And then all of a sudden it's like kaboom. And it's
and
like,
where
whoa,
did
where
that energy
come from? Yes.
Where did that energy come from? And the energy came from her countenance, her look, her demeanor. And he got caught up in the slipstream of that. So this is how I see the world and life. Like, I'm always looking for that. Oh, that's a little moment there. That's a little tweak. Energy happening. And I'm always looking for the magic. And so you could actually say, ooh, that was a little bit of dark magic happening. That was a lot of dark magic happening because that magic moved him beyond his ability to think through the next step.
So that's our digression. Back to vampire.
Yeah.
So you're doing the vampire thing, and we haven't got to the middle age part yet. So why don't you just pick up from where I interrupted?
So basically, my love for vampires came even before... after interview, but before Twilight, and when Twilight caught the world by storm and drove teenage girls and moms crazy, Blade, Wesley Snipes putting on a pair of sunglasses and a leather coat and kicking vampire butt as a vampire hybrid did that for me. And if you're a Marvel fan, you already know that there are tons of Marvel heads who believe that Blade was really the foundation for what we know of and understand the Marvel Universe to be, because that movie took us beyond Batman, good and bad, and blah, blah, blah. And it's just, we're just going to be doing some ass kicking. And also, there's going to be this vampire who just so happens to be black. It was just, and Wesley Snipes as Blade, like, that to me is iconic. Mm. And
I remember him.
That look. And that leap, all the things we've come to understand and know, the superhero as they jump down off a building and they land, on one knee and one hand, that Superman pose or what have you, that was happening.
It was a perfect role for him because he always has kind of this otherworldly presence anyway.
Yes.
He always seems like he's set aside from every situation, every situation he's in, every person he's with or every group he's with. He seems like, I'm the different guy here. I'm working in a different vibratory state. And he was just right for that role.
Yeah. And there have been other amazing vampires and vampire, males, females, but we don't see many black women as vampires. And if they are a vampire, they're dusted, within 5 minutes. Their role was just to be part of the fight scene and boom, they're gone. And so I was just like, so what if the Daywalker's a woman? And also, what if she happens to be middle-aged? And also, what if she has this little twist, this little secret about why? And so I can't tell you, really why she became this vampire, but yeah, it's like, all right, let's, you know, so it's Duana living out her fantasy. If she were
Duana being your
freaking,
name, DM.
Yes, DM.
DM. Duana.
Yes.
The
she,
D and DM is Duana.
Duana.
We're listening to
yes.
you now. How many, you're going to start writing a series of these books, and you don't have a certain number in mind. I suspect that until you come up with another subject that fires your interest again, or you just feel like I've it's run its course, so I'm on to something else. But when's the first one coming out?
So the first one I am finishing, and I actually wrote it last year and threw it up for like a week and was like, oh no. And I took it down and I am revamping it. And I actually have a trilogy planned, and because I'm still old school, you know, with trilogies are still my thing. And there are like some other characters that have started speaking to me, and they're like, look, we need you to hurry up with this vampire chick, because we want to tell our story, and it's back to witches, and it's kind of like a, you know, Witches of Eastwick happening in Charleston, but not without the Jack Nicholson. And so,
mm-hmm.
So I have all these other characters vying for my attention, and I went back and I realized the thing though that women my age enjoy with no matter what type of story you give them, you need to give them a little romance. And I didn't give the romance the way I could have. And so I am reworking that and plan to re-release this summer. So I'm really excited about it because I think this iteration is the one that it's the way it was supposed to be. So sometimes I think I get ahead of myself. And, you know, as a writer, you want to write what you want to read, but also you need to write, especially if you want to sell things, you need to write with your audience in mind. That doesn't mean pander to your audience. That means write a good story that you believe your audience is going to buy into and be interested in reading from start to finish and be willing to, like, tell a story so good that you want them to be like, damn it, when's that next book? Or why didn't she write more like this? So that's
right.
What I aim to do when I, you know, when my fingers are on the keyboard.
Interesting. So are you a spiritual person?
I would definitely say I'm spiritual. I was raised in Southern Baptist church, and, you know, as soon as I was able to make my own choices as an adult, I did, and opted out. And so I...
But you believe in the metaphysical?
I do, absolutely. And more in interconnectedness, I think, than what you typically see in traditional Western religion.
Right.
Yeah.
In other words, you don't believe, not so much duality as oneness, that life is a force field, energy force field, and much more than that. But there, that's a component of it, is that the energy. So how does that feed into, how do your beliefs, your spiritual beliefs, or your metaphysical beliefs feed into your writing? I mean, they obviously do in a significant way. Is there anything to be said about that?
Not really. I think I borrow from African, and I use that term loosely because we know that, you know, Africa, the African American experience is very different than, you know, Africans of the diaspora around the world. And so I borrow traditions in terms of ancestors having influence or being able to even access your ancestors, and that we all carry a little DNA of our family's histories. We carry the memories, some of those memories unconsciously in our DNA. And also, you know, I'm Southern, so we are tied to the land in many ways. And I remember a message my mom gave me as, you know, coming up as an adult and getting divorced and moving home. It was, you need to buy property because that is how you establish wealth. And that is a sign of, you know, like adulthood and the whole thing. And so I think, you know, I take things, you know, breaking bread, which is a concept across the world in every freaking culture. And I just share how my culture does it. And the thing is, folks who are from different cultures get it. And they're like, yeah, we do that. Or, you know, we don't do that, but we do this. Or, you know, we do something similar. And so I'm just sharing universal truths. I don't think I'm speaking to anything particularly fancy or unique. I'm hoping that I'm tapping into what is just a basic human truth.
Mm-hmm. Do you think the timing is particularly good now? I mean, we've seen there's been a real effort, finally a real effort in publishing and in television, the movies, entertainment in general, to get a lot more diverse voices, whether they be ethnic, race, gender, sexuality, and you name it. I would imagine it right now, being a Black writer, it's a better time to be a Black writer than ever. Would you agree,
absolutely,
or is that not been you? Yeah?
Nope, absolutely. And not just because the publishing industry has, like, come calling, but readers have come calling. And I will share this. I know, you know, we've been talking for a minute, but I am the chair of a small festival here in Charleston called the Black Ink Book Festival. And it started in 2016, originally to uplift Black voices, specifically Black writers from the Charleston area. And we have grown, and partially thanks to COVID, because we had to go virtual so that folks could be safe. And we've grown from a tiny little festival with, you know, 100 some odd in-person attendees. And we had, you know, great, we had Terry McMillan, we had Nikki Giovanni, we had some really amazing speakers. But our virtual festival allowed us to double and darn near triple the amount of people we could reach and folks could hear. And so in January, our sixth event and second virtual event, we had Black writers who were able to actually pitch to agents and book publishers. And I'm talking some of the big book publishers who virtually made themselves available so that folks could pitch. And I am just excited about that because it's exposure that they wouldn't have necessarily gotten a few years ago. But the flip side of that is that also indie writers are finding audiences and making a living. Minority writers, women writers, who traditionally would have not had the same level of access and are like knocking it out of the park financially for themselves and their families because folks are able to find, you know, somebody watches a TikTok book review and they're like, hey, I read this book by so-and-so. So-and-so's this little indie publisher. Folks find her or him on Amazon and their sales fly through the roof because somebody read their book and just shared it on this platform. So I do think that this is an amazing time in terms of being a minority or non-majority writer because people are clamoring for good stories. And they're, you know, if Bridgerton and some of the other successful multicultural shows have shown us is that there's a market for this, as mm-hmm. long as it's wrapped in a good story. No one wants to be pandered to. Don't just put some minorities in there to make it interesting. Like, make that an amazing freaking story, and we're all here for it.
Right.
We don't
right.
care. We're just going to show up and tune in.
Yeah. I forget, you know, the first season, Bridgerton, you had the African-American actor. I don't even know his name, but...
Ray Jean Page.
There you go. Well, it was palpable, the disappointment among women when he wasn't there for the second season.
Right.
It's like, there's a whole new story, and it's like, still a good season, but it's kind of like everybody, all the women wanted him back. And
yes.
But he's on to other things now. So just
Absolutely.
The way you said his name said it all. It was, you know... It was dripping with lasciviousness, let's put it that way.
Absolutely.
So what do you do for your steady paycheck? What's your daytime job?
I am a director of development for a nonprofit organization. So I write grants and I tell our story and I convince people to... donate their hard-earned money to make an impact in their community and the community around us. And so we serve a small neighborhood, about 5 square miles of intense poverty here in Charleston, in a city that is brimming over with wealth. But this particular community was left behind, in some ways intentionally. And by intentionally, I don't mean people sat around and said, hey, let's figure out how we're going to leave this population behind. But the policies and the things mm-hmm. that were done, while it was lifting up some other folks, it basically ignored what was going on with these particular communities. And so we work in providing education support, healthcare, and mobilizing residents to really advocate on their own behalf for the things they want to see in their community and in their schools. So that's my day job.
Yeah.
And then I try to come home and write a few hundred words a day and keep this writing thing going.
Well, and just to build on what you said, I mean, that's how, you know, Black communities do get left behind. It's not, it's usually not. I think it's actually rare that it's an intentional attempt to screw a part of the population. And that's part of what makes prejudice or the situation so intractable is that it's like, what did I didn't do anything. I didn't do anything wrong. It's like, and people don't realize that in just serving yourself, a lot of times you're not looking past yourself at what the ramifications are for other people or other parts of society. And again, this gets to nuance. This gets to understanding
right.
something that's more subtle than that. Yeah, okay, so you don't use bad words or you don't say anything negative about people of different colors, but that doesn't mean that you're picking up on all the subtleties that are injurious to that population.
Yeah.
I mean, that kind of stuff just goes on.
Right. And when I say unintentional, so I actually have and this would be a podcast for another day. So I believe that in modern times, folks have been unintentional, but the systems were actually very intentional, the way that the systems were set up. Mm-hmm. And there's this amazing course or program, and I believe it's out of North Carolina, and it's called the Racial Equity Institute. And what they actually do is come into communities and they show you how, not just how the laws were enacted from this country's very beginning, and because folks were leaving England and they were fleeing taxes, unfair taxes, and religious persecution. But what inevitably happened was what we know now as our system of slavery and wealth creation. And so I always tell people, if you want to understand how things happen in a community, follow the money.
Totally.
And you will then be able to completely unravel the follow the money, and it will lead you to some of the key laws that we have in place. We're often founded as a preser. And I'm sorry, my dog
that's
is
fine.
Losing his
no, that's fine.
Mess right now.
Not but, only follow the money, but what you will discover almost inevitably is there's a circle of money. There's these
yes.
people who are basically handing the loot off to one another, and
that
you know
fine.
you're in the circle. The money's being handed around. If you're outside
yes.
the circle,
you
go wanting. Yes.
Yes,
you're not part of it.
Absolutely,
and they're not.
Absolutely.
They have no interest in sharing it. I mean, not because even necessarily that. I mean, many of them are bad people, but a lot of times it's not that people are bad. It's that people, it's just people. I mean, I've seen families torn apart when somebody dies and money's left behind. And
yes.
I was floored. It's just like that family is coming apart because somebody left some money behind. I mean, it's unbelievable
yes.
what money does to people.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So...
So how do you, I want to tell you, Black Ink Book Festival, what a great name, the Black Ink Book Festival. And it sounds like it's gaining some real power, some real traction there. It sounds fantastic. Talk about how you write. You say you try to squeeze out a few hundred words a day. Are you a systematic writer? Do you have a time of day? Do you have a place? Is it just, hey, I've got 30 minutes here, or I'm waiting in line at the grocery store and I got my notepad and pen?
So I try to take at least 15 minutes a day, because what happens is work and life can get so overwhelming. I have had long periods of not writing and thinking about writing and feeling guilty about not writing. And what I've started doing recently is 15 minutes a day, like legit, that's it. And typically if I can get through those first 10 minutes, I can get through another, I can probably do 30 minutes a day.
Mm.
And so it's,
So you make it easy.
What I found.
I mean, you give yourself
yes.
a low, you're not asking yourself to sit down for 2 or 4 hours a day because
right.
you've set the bar low. It doesn't intimidate. You can always find 15 minutes, and then once you're doing it, the time expands because, look, I'm in the middle of it now. I'm not going to stop right now.
Right, exactly. And like last night is a prime example. It was a friend's 57th birthday. She teaches yoga. I went to a yoga class, came home, showered. Now it's, 9 o'clock, talking to my husband because, they want your attention too. And
mm-hmm.
now it's 10 o'clock, and he's like, well, I'm clocking out early. I'm going to go to the office early tomorrow. And so now it's 10:30, and I'm about to dig deep into something on television. And I was like, oh, but you haven't written today. And so I said, and sometimes I make it even super easy, 100 words. And I was like, okay, Duana, 100 words, that's all you got, and then you go to bed. And I wrote 250 words, and it was like, okay, got it. So when I'm done with this call, I will do, something very similar because I have a work thing to go to. So I'll just sit 15 minutes, bang something out. And what I found, it doesn't sound like a lot, but when I'm a student of productivity, and they're always like, it's not the large chunks that get you to the finish line, it's the consistency. So
mm-hmm.
it's, nice if, what difference does it make if you don't write for 6 months and then you sit down and the first time you write is 3,000 words, but then you don't write for another 6 months.
Right, right.
Which I have been guilty of doing. So what if you just be like, here's 10 minutes, here's, and I do have friends who like write in the grocery line or what have you. And when I realized when I took the pressure off to say, write something every day, there have been days when I managed to write one sentence, closed the laptop, and was like, well, that's all I got. But then the next day, I'm like pouring, you know, thoughts are pouring out of me.
Right.
Give yourself space to, I have finally learned to give myself space to just not, to just work my own pace. And when I can do more, I do. And if I can't, I give it something.
Right. You know, we had a guy on the program. He wrote an article. This falls right into line with what you're talking about. He wrote an article for Writer's Digest where he made a commitment to write one word a day. And he said, but by the time you open the laptop and you fire it up, you're not going to write just one word. You end up writing 50 or 100 or 1,000.
Right.
And he said, and there was one time that I literally wrote one word. I was just spent. I opened it up. I wrote one word. I just couldn't do anymore. He said, that happened just one time, though. Take the pressure off is the lesson, is really take the pressure off and open that door. And once that door is open, more comes through it than you probably would expect. You know, your vampire, you know, black vampires, I mean, that sounds like cinema right there. It sounds like it could so easily become black cinema, which wouldn't be black cinema anymore. It's cinema because I think one of the things, certainly that they've realized, I mean, what was the name of the Crazy Rich Asians, I think? And wasn't even really a very good movie, but it did huge at the box office because it was demonstrated that, look, you can have a movie that's almost entirely Asian characters. It pretty much was entirely Asian characters, and it sold huge. It wasn't even that good of a movie. And it's been demonstrated with black cinema as well. I mean, what the Black Panther was, what, the best-selling superhero movie ever or something like that? Maybe not superhero movie, but it was huge.
It broke for its time. It broke, I mean, it was short-lived, but it did break some of Marvel records at that time. And I think like a month or two later, the next whatever Marvel thing came out and broke that record. But, yeah.
And the vamp, just the whole vampire thing is a magnet. There's no question about that. And what you're talking about is really a little different take on it. It's not just that it's would be black actors, but also you're really focused on middle age. And there's no end to those possibilities there. So the fully realized Dion Brockington would be remembered as who? Or what?
Ooh. First and foremost, a lover of story. And I would say definitely quirky. I think I've fought really for years. I fought so hard to, you know, people always talk about be your authentic self, blah, 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 to the point where nobody, like, it's so overdone and overused and it's ridiculous. But I think just being a quirky version, best version of myself, I think, you know, when I think about what my friends would say about me, what my family would say about me, I you know, want folks to enjoy life because it's going to kick you in the nuts repeatedly, but you can still find your joy. And, like, I think that's, you know, so my witches are my joy. My vampires are my joy. I have a series of goddesses that are, like, trying to form, like, they're forming a band and wanting to disrupt stuff in my head. And I'm just like, no, but you know, find that thing that makes you magic. And I think the thing that makes me magic is that I am unapologetic about enjoying my life.
We all should be that way. And just even enjoying, as you know, you didn't put it quite this way, but obviously we run into, you know, a lot of bad experiences along the way and all that, but there's also just the absurdity of life. I mean, the absurd situations, and to find humor in that and to find really delight in that, because it's a comedy in motion. Life is really kind of a comedy in motion, and very serious things happen. But even in the midst of very serious stuff, there's there's a lot of comedy and a lot of absurdity that goes on that I think gets lost. Again, when we talk about nuances and subtleties of life, it can so easily get lost. I love the way you talk about you look for story in everything. So can you give us one or two examples of that you saw something or were watching something and kind of a sketch of maybe an idea that came from that?
Absolutely. So this book is an idea I have from listening. So I'm not sure if you've heard of the Murdoch Murders. There's a podcast.
I've heard of it, yeah.
Okay.
So I don't know what it is, but I've heard of it. Okay. Its name precedes it.
Yes, it's a set of murders and weird deaths that happen in a small county in Hampton, South Carolina, tied to this one very wealthy family. And I started listening to it last year. I was on a walk, and my daughter was like, "Mom, I can't believe blah, blah, blah." And, you know, we exchange murder podcasts all the time. And I'm listening to it, and I was on a particularly long walk, and just listening to the political shenanigans and the, you know, all that comes with being an extremely wealthy family in a very poor county in the South. And I immediately had an idea for a story about what if there was an illegitimate black child of this family, and what if this illegitimate black child came from a long line of witches, and what if, and literally built out, right? So I'm listening right. to one amazing story and enjoying the heck out of it, and my brain just is like, yeah, but what if this happened? And so I can be in the target line and will start making up stuff about the people, how they're engaging in front of me. So if it's a mom and she's got a cart full of crap and trying to wrangle three boys, like, what's her altar? What's that mom's secret life? Do these boys even know how amazing that mom is, and that, you know, when she's not feeding them, clothing them, keeping their house clean and shuttling them to X, Y, or Z because dad's off doing whatever, that she's, you know, saving the world or whatever. Like, I make up stories about people and things all the time. And it's just based off of basic interaction and engagement.
It's a fun thing to do too. You see a couple people and you just kind of, I used to play this game with my ex-wife where I would see maybe a man and a woman, and I would say something about such and such is going on with them, or they're running a scam, or he's kidnapped her, you know, that sort of thing. And we would play with that. We would play with that from there. And just sometimes you look at two people and you get an immediate impression of what might be going on there, but I don't think many people, and I want to do a lot more of this because you've really inspired me to the idea of, just as I move from place to place and thing to thing and see people and see events transpire, to be more aware of finding the story, the alternate story or the side story within that. Well, Dan Brockington, this has been a lot of fun. You're a great interview. And you have a lot of, you know, quality thoughts. And there's a lot more places to go with this. I am going to be pulling for you 100%. And I'm going to look for you on the big screen, your book, your adaptation on the big screen one day, because I think you got a great shot at it, given your subject matter. So thank you for taking the time. I appreciate it very much.
I have had an absolute blast, and I thank you for the invitation, and this has been this is the best part of the day. So when I get to talk about writing and then actually go do some writing. So thank you so much for the invitation.